Is that better? Okay, great. It's a delight to be back with you again today, and you never know what every week is going to bring, right? You never know what every week is going to bring. And I'm going to open in prayer, and I have a special prayer request for a friend of my family that's in a pretty bad advanced state of cancer, and they're going to do some major operations in the next week or so. And I just want to take a second, if you would agree with me in prayer, to lift this individual up at the beginning of our prayer, that God would be aggressively kind and aggressively active into the situation. Okay? Father, we come to you. You are a good-hearted God. And we bring Larry before you and ask that you would break into his situation and brood over the family and over his body and his heart and the morale of the people that are praying for him today. And that you would show yourself strong as his Redeemer and touch his body and his life and his heart and his family. We ask this for the glory of your Son, that praise would be generated for him. For our class today, we would ask that you would give us clear hearts and open minds, that we could gaze up at your Son on the cross, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, and that we could learn to understand what was bought for us by that suffering, that you would give us some glimpse, some further understanding, and certainly some appreciation for the loyalty that he had for us that took him to that road, to that cross. So teach us. Reveal your Son to us today, that we might fall in love with him and serve him all our lives. Amen. Okay, we are on page 4. There's obviously heavy things going on in my life, so you're going to have to bear with this a couple of times today, no doubt. But we are in a section on redemption and ransom. And we started last week, and we started going through what this word meant. And if you remember on the first page of your syllabus, it fans better, you know, when it's folded like this than when you do it around. We started out by pointing out 4 very real elements in our lives that are after us, as opposed to just some kind of general malaise that where we just drift and we stumble over things. These are things that are out to get us sometimes. And sometimes it's the old, we have met the enemy and he is us. And we'll get into that pretty heavy today, probably. But these 4 things about the reality of oppression, that they are, that we do have enemies, that there are things that would like to sabotage us, including ourselves and things of that type. There are realities of this. There is violence in our world. The second one was the reality of the consequence engine, that you do, generally speaking, reap what you sow. That generally the effects, because they were set up this way for good, when you launch something out into history, when you launch something into time and space, God guarantees that it's going to produce results. Therefore, we have a predictable world. And therefore, we can plan, we can build things, because it has an element of predictability. When we misuse that consequence engine, of course, we do damage to just about every relationship in the universe. The reality of voluntary slavery, we get ourselves in situations that are quite difficult, and we have to do expedient things. We have to do compromises. We have to settle for lesses. We have to settle for limited objectives. And we get ourselves in situations, Proverbs says a good one, he that is lazy is put to forced march. Or somebody has to march under bayonets. Because they wait too late. The reality of alienation, of course, is a major theme for the last 50 years of our, at least Western civilization, the loneliness, the fact that things are broken, that we feel alone in the universe, we feel alone in our families, we feel alone in our social circles, that there are those moments of quietness where we sense that things are not as what they should be. And it's those four elements that, if you don't misunderstand the metaphor, that the violent invasion of our world by God was, He didn't leave us to ourselves. We'll talk about how He bared His mighty arm, stretched forth His arm, as we look at some of the passages on the Exodus today. And what we got into last week was the background in the ancient Near East. We looked at the historical cultures, that they all had these basic notions that redemption, this fuzzy word that we don't know in the 20th century, it had to do with ransom, where somebody was in a pickle of a fix, as we would say where I grew up, in a pickle of a fix, and you would go over there and you'd bail them out. You'd put bail money up and you'd get them out of jail, or you would somehow work out a deal, but it always cost you something to do this. And we saw that this was in the background of the Old Testament cultures of the nations around Israel in her history. And then we started last week into the various how the words redemption was used in Israel. And we noticed something different, though. We had two different words for redemption. We had one word that everybody shared. It was that word padad. And everybody had this notion of redemption, that you paid a price and you bought somebody out of slavery. You bought somebody out of being punished for a legitimate crime that they did, a real crime that they did, legitimate consequences. You bailed them out. We had, and that was a generalized notion across the world. But there was another word that we have never figured out where it came from, the Goel Redeemer. We don't have any antecedents to that word in the other languages that was Israel was around. Like most of the words in Hebrew, you know, have background words that we can trace those. This one we can't. And this was the notion of the kinsman redeemer that we looked at. This is somebody who was loyal to you from day one. Somebody that had your interest in mind from day one. And when you got in a situation where you had sold yourself into a bad situation or you had been violated by some act of will of somebody else, they were strong for you. They stopped what they were doing and came to rescue, came to bail you out, came to help you. It was out of the ordinary help. It was extra help. It wasn't the day-to-day friendship at the table or helping it out. This is where you drop, you let go of the plow, and you go bail your little buddy out. Okay? And we looked at a number of situations in the Old Testament how you could redeem. For example, if I became, poverty-stricken in Israel, I could sell myself as an indentured slave servant for 6 or 7 years. Basically, I could just say, okay, here's my labor price. You know, here's what you're going to get out of me. It was a labor deal, and in return for room and board. And my brother, if he did successfully well at his job and earned his quarterly bonuses as an executive, he could theoretically come and buy me out. Buy me back and put me back at home. Okay, same thing about a house and lands and fields and things of this type. When I got into trouble, I could do this. And we looked through a couple of these things down through the end of page 3, the blood redeemer. And we stopped at page 4 under the last note. We talked about the blood avenger before we get to see God as redeemer. We talked about the blood redeemer as that kinsman. And it basically, they had, of course, no police. You don't have police or prisons or anything in tribal Israel. You know, there was nothing, there were no official government bodies of that type. There were judges, there were rulers, and there were elders, and the elders passed judgment. But there were no official, you know, executioner types. And this was a responsibility done by the tribe in the case of violent crimes, such as we looked at last week, murder, violent murder, intentional murder, and rape. But God extends us a little further in the notion of God, of legal action, of strong help. In these verses here, under that last bullet before we get to God as Redeemer on page 4. Notice also that this applies to less than murder legal situations. So I had a Goel Redeemer, I had a kinsman person, somebody that I was related to legally or by blood or something, that would act in these others. The first verse there is from Proverbs. Do not move the ancient boundary or go into the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their case against you. Now, who's the Redeemer in this case? God. Okay. Now, God had a special relationship to the aliens, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the orphans and the widows of the land. They generally did not have a tremendous amount of legal rights, and the legal rights that they had were very often abused and overridden by the power elite, very often in Israel. Prophets, a third of all the Old Testament prophets complain about the way Israelites treat other Israelites in these kind of contexts. And what you have here is the Redeemer. God is going to, in an act of kinship, as an act of relationship and solidarity with these people, will plead their case. Will drop what they're doing, drop what he's doing, so to speak, and go plead the case in the law court. Will argue, will make a case, will demonstrate evidence, will vindicate the righteous, vindicate the oppressed, vindicate the marginalized here. And here's a case where it's further than just rape or murder. This is where somebody has moved the ancient boundary. Now, for those of you that have trudged through the book of Numbers and the book of Joshua, where they set up the boundary stones, where they describe where each little tribe has its little lot. And they say, three steps over from the tree of Morah, there's a rock. And from that rock to where the creek moves to 1 meter distance over here in passage, and then you go 147 steps over here to those two fig trees, one of which is taller than the other. And they described the boundaries of the land this way, and they were boundary marks. Now, if the boundary mark was a movable thing like a rock, under cover of darkness, I could change the fence line between me and my neighbor. And so when we're squabbling over where to put the satellite dish or the cable thing, those 2 a.m. rezoning, if you will, I could go pick up that rock, move it over 3 feet, presto change-o, boom, look at this. Well, they come out and say, what's happened? Why are there bugs crawling out under this old empty spot there? And I say, well, don't look at me. I was asleep. When you move the ancient boundary, you rob somebody of something that was theirs. Okay? And if they did not have the ability to defend themselves in court for any number of reasons, okay, their Redeemer would show himself strong. Okay? That's a passage that says lesser crimes than violent crimes, but these were crimes of oppression. The next one, though. Lord, O Lord, thou didst plead my soul's cause. Thou hast redeemed my life. O Lord, thou hast seen my oppression. Judge my case. Alright, so here's somebody where I am being oppressed, and it's not in this particular case necessarily for anything I've done wrong. Separate issue, we'll talk about that. But in the case where I'm being hassled by somebody trying to take advantage of me, you've redeemed my life, I belong to you, you have bought me, plead my case. Show up in court and defend my case, my soul's cause. Okay? So the Redeemer would get involved in more than just the big things of life. They would get involved in the little things of life. God didn't just bring him out of Egypt and said, boom, done, you're on your own, go for it. But it's in the tiny little details, which, praise God, we are dependent upon him for those constant actions. Okay? I mean, I need big things, you know, but I need lots and lots of little more things than I need big things in life, for any number of reasons. Okay, the third one. Look upon my affliction and rescue me, for I do not forget thy law. Plead my cause and redeem me. Okay? I'm in trouble somehow, for good or ill, for legitimate reasons or not, I am in trouble. Please take a legal stance and get active and redeem me, rescuing me in this process. I'm going to fall into a consequence engine, or I'm going to fall into the hands of an oppression, and I need you to rescue me. Show up in court, drop what you're doing, exercise your wisdom, your strength, your power within the community as the head elder. For he delivers the needy when they call, the poor and those that have no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life. And precious in their blood is their blood in his sight. From oppression and violence, he redeems his life. Now, notice that's one of those themes about violent oppression. Again, this is the case of just the common Israelite that is under oppression. Violence is being perpetrated of various forms. And it is out of that, from this onslaught of violence, that God plucks them out, redeems. Okay, so he delivers them, but we will see in a section or two that it always involves a cost to God. The reason it's not just the standard word deliver or rescue, but that it's this word redeem, which is a big difference. Okay, that if you had to make a map, salvation and its global fuzzy considerations would map to rescue or salvage in the English language. Rescue or salvage. Okay, but redemption would not be there. Redemption would be at personal cost. It would be a price paid. We'll see this. Okay, the price may be everything from blood to money to a substitute, or it could be personal effort, personal torment of soul, labor. Okay, that's what we'll see when we get to the Exodus. So that's how redemption was used in Israel. The common Israelite, when you said the word redeem, they did not think of a religious term. Much as in the New Testament, when we get there, when Paul would go out and say something about redemption, everybody would think in terms of the marketplace. They wouldn't think about this. They wouldn't be thinking about a religious thing. But the notion of redeem, that I got in trouble, or somebody was after me, and somebody that was in solidarity with me and cared for me, even though they might have argued me at the dinner table every night for 50 years growing up, my little brothers or sisters or whatever, when it came down to it, boom, they would act that part. They would act that part. Okay, and it is this notion that just lives in Israel as a common day economic metaphor, an economic model that is applied in this next section to God as Redeemer. Now, God as Redeemer, I've got like four sections there, I think. One about his individual actions. Two is the big one about the Exodus. Then three is when they went into Babylon as exile, when he brings them back. And then there's this one about the future, of which we participate. And so let's take a look at each one of these. In first one is in individual circumstance. So this is rank and file Joe Israelite. Okay? And notice the first quote here is, the concept that God was the ultimate redeemer, rescuer of the individual and of the collective body, which means just the nation or the tribe or the family, from adversity. So this is redemption from adversity, was deeply entrenched in Israelite thought already during the pre-exilic period. Before they went into, back in the days of Solomon and the kings of Israel, they already had this concept inside that God not only saved the big things like the nation, but that he might be interested in redeeming me or my family or my tribe from adversity. Jacob's blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh in Genesis 48 provides a good illustration in its reference to the angel who redeemed me from all evil. The Lord who redeemed Abraham, God redeems from unspecified troubles. So when Jacob gets up there and he talks about he's on his deathbed, and he's describing the actions of God in his life, the angel of Yahweh, what we generally believe to be the pre-incarnate ministry of Christ, before he became Christ, the Son of God, second person of the Trinity in technical theological terms, that basically he's described here as redeeming Jacob from all evil. Now, evil, of course, is a pretty broad word in Israel. It could be the evil I do, redeems me from the evil that I should be busted for, okay? Or it could be the evil that other people are trying to perpetrate upon me. Or it could be just the consequences of evil, which is disaster, estrangement, disruption of the community and the nation. And generally, it meant all of those. In other words, that we lived in this kind of a world until it's specific to where he said, redeem me from wickedness, transact. There are a lot of specific words for the various moral failures that we do. A lot of specific words, okay? Some much stronger than others, okay? And the fact that when they use a general word for evil, evil often in the context of the Old Testament means disastrous consequences and things of this type. So here's just this global concept that if I had to sum up my life, Jacob says, here on my deathbed, and Jacob had been through a lot, if you know much about Jacob's life, he said, for somehow, in spite of all the things that happened in his life, he can say with clear conscience, under the legal authority of his deathbed will, that the angel of God had redeemed me, rescued me from all the evils. Okay? Now, what that means, practically speaking to today's world, that doesn't mean that you're going to get out of all the trouble that Jacob went through. Redeeming means that in some cases, you just survive it without extreme bitterness and a cynicism that kills the soul. Sometimes you live through it without your dreams and your hopes being crushed and ground to powder. Sometimes you can see a bigger picture and you grow from it, and things happen that reach further into the lives of your family and your friends. So, redemption from evil has a much broader picture than simple getting out of jail free card. There are things that we would love to be, people that we would love to be in our quietest of moments, that things in our lives are orchestrated to produce in us. Well, it is not always fun. It is not always fun, as you well know. And in this particular case, Jacob, it was a lot of non-fun. It was a lot of non-fun that Jacob had. But he could still, at the end of his life, say, the God who has redeemed me from all, bought me out. It costs God something. And we'll see a little bit about, when we look into each individual passage, how that's the case. People prayed to God. Individuals prayed to God to be redeemed, to be rescued with a payment out of certain types of things. So let's look at a couple of these passages. The first one are from enemies. The first one was from enemies. Thou wilt pull me out of the net which they have secretly laid for me. For thou art my strength. Into thy hand I commit my spirit. Thou hast ransomed me, O Lord God of truth. Now here's a case where an enemy has spread a net. Okay, so there's a trap that's laid, and the image of the net is of the hunter and the fowler that basically captures animals for sale. And so they lay out this net and they disguise the net. And here the psalmist is saying, you know, they've laid a net. There are enemies out there that are trying to trap me. They're trying to move the boundary stones at night. They're splitting splendor around me, destroying my testimony. They're disrupting my personal relationships with my fellow merchants, with my families, because people are doubting me and they're hearing these things. They're enemies that have laid traps for me, and I need help. And so I ask you, God, to redeem me. Buy me out of this somehow. Invest something and pull me out of this from my enemies. The next one. Why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul has sunk down into the dust. Our body cleaves to the earth. Rise up, be our help, and redeem us for the sake of your loving kindness. The image there about clinging to the dust and lying to the ground is that basically in our English we'd say one foot in the grave. They're already being held and being pulled down by the earth into their death and demise and the loss of their ability to influence the community for good. And that's where they are. They try to get up and do good, but there's no way. And they say, redeem us. Pull us out of this. Rescue us somehow from this impotence, from this helplessness that we feel to make a difference, to deal effectively with affliction and oppression, to deal with the calamities in our life. The next one, he will redeem my soul in peace from the battle which is against me. For they are many who strive with me. Now, the psalmist, quite a number of the Psalms, of course, were written by David. And if you know much about David's life, he was always being chased by somebody. Just always. If it wasn't his enemies, it were the prophets that were after him for various and sundry things that he did personally wrong. But he's always got tons of enemies. Most of the kings back in those days had tons of enemies. And as you can imagine, in a state where you had no police force and things of this type, the number of enemies that an individual might have could be substantial. They wouldn't be, you would see that, you don't see that quite as much in our culture because of the way it's sort of structured, but You certainly see this at executive levels sometimes. Executive levels where you've got up at the top level, every now and then you have, not uniformly, but every now and then you have people with what I would call inappropriate arrogance levels up there that are fighting over turf and territory, sometimes for the right reasons and sometimes for the wrong reasons. But there are enemies that do get made up there. There are enemies that get made among professional politicians. There are enemies that get made, you know, and this is a reality. But it was a little more common among people of influence in Israel, gathering from what we can see in the text. It was a frequent problem. But if you were the king, that's a special problem. There were always people after your throne. There were always people after your job, including, as we know from David's case, your kids. Your kids were always after your job for some reason. Many that strive, redeem my soul in peace from the battle. He's trying to get to peace out of battle. Okay, most of us are trying to do this ourselves. And do not hide thy face from thy servant, for I am in distress. Most of us don't need a translation for what the word distress means. Answer me quickly. Oh, draw near to my soul and redeem it. Ransom me because of my enemies! Exclamation point. Okay. Normally, when you pray for ransoming or redemption, you always put a "hurry up, God" clause on the end. You don't say, "At your own perfect timing, O Lord, redeem me from my present distress because I'm about to die." So, if you could come before death, it would be preferable. We would be most pleasing in my eyes. So there's generally a sense of urgency associated with this, as you can well imagine. So enemies were one. Wicked being a special category of enemies, of course, were the wicked. And the wicked were those that were overtly against the law of Israel and overtly against the welfare of the people and the community. They were a little bit stronger. And so you have here in Psalms, do not take my soul along with sinners, nor my life with men of bloodshed, in whose hands is a wicked scheme, and whose right hand is full of bribes. But as for me, I shall walk in my integrity, redeem me, and be gracious to me. Here the psalmist he lives in a community. And there are a number of people, the sinners and the men of bloodshed. They are bribers. They're trying to pervert justice generally. They've got wicked schemes. This is premeditated bribery and oppression of others and a perversion of good ethical standards in the community. The psalmist is in the middle of them and says, I'm not like them, so when you sweep them over the cliff, would you separate me out first, basically. Okay, that's what the prayer is, because that was an issue in the nation of Israel, because there was close corporate ties. The people that you hung out with, sometimes in those days, because of the nature of the old covenant, you got in trouble if your neighbor violated something. Now, God didn't enforce this a lot, but there were times where he had to be strong about this. First one, who can think of the big one, the first one, in Joshua? Achan's trespass, remember? That he didn't normally do this in other cases, by the way. But this was, when you're first starting out, you got to say, here's the ground rules. If you start high, you're going to degenerate low. But if you start low, you just get worse. And so you got to sort of, you know, draw a line and say, let's put a stake in the ground here. There'll be plenty of grace all around this. Believe me, when we get through this, and there's billions of passages in the Old Testament where he didn't press the law. He said, okay, I won't smite you. You're not supposed to be carrying the thing on a cart, the ark on a cart. You're supposed to carry the shoulders, but I won't kill you. But if you grab it around the shoulders, that's over the line. What else can I do? I remember writing a passage on that about what God as the parent had to, how you draw the lines of where you draw the line with the kid, because they step over those lines and you don't know at what point has it become an active rebellion thing, and even in the active rebellion, at what point does it become an intentional, really spiteful thing that needs to be dealt with, as opposed to just more mild correction and wisdom instruction, things of this type. And there's always a, always a fuzzy thing as to, you know, where do you say, okay, got to stop. We got to stop here. You know, we stop at 10 o'clock. You were supposed to go to bed at 9:30. Grace went this far and it stops here. I got to draw the line somewhere so you just don't push it and push it and push it. And there's so many cases in the Old Testament where you can see that dynamic going in, where God has been patient and patient, and they have violated countless things in His laws, and yet He hasn't visited them with affliction. You know, they're always doing the wrong things with ephods and idols and high places, even, you know, before He got made a real big deal out of the thing. And He's always cutting them slack, and He's always cutting them slack. And it's only when that spills over into extremely deadly community relations where they start sacrificing their children in those places, and when they start oppressing and violence, that God says, no, we can't get that far. I can't get that far. I won't let you shed innocent blood on the land. Yes?
It seems to go all the way from, as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord, like, you know, separating yourself. And but on the other hand, Joshua and Caleb and all the people who brought the good report had to wander 40 years too.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, see, there's a good case where He both singled them out and yet still they had the solidarity. So in the case of Joshua and Caleb, they did suffer through the 40 years, but because they had been faithful, they were singled out and they got their inheritance. They didn't die in the wilderness. It's a good point. Good mix of the two. And you can see the difficulties of trying to figure, you know, I am increasingly always, you know, the wiser I get, the more glad that I am not God. You know, and because the few times that I've tried it have not been very successful. Let's put it this way. I was telling my girlfriend that there are times that sometimes I say, now, both our names start with G, but His is God and mine is Glenn. Okay, let's make sure I get this clear. Let's keep this clear as to who is, where our relationships are here, God. And the difficulty of governance, we have this, you know, from an executive standpoint, you have this thing called corporate governance. And it's such a difficult concept of corporate ethics. You know, Preston works in this. He knows how complicated this is. He has to teach this. And students perhaps think it's more complicated than Preston does. But that's after reading the syllabus and the articles and things that he writes, right? But this is such a difficult concept. And we too often from our side presume upon God that, well, if I were God, I would have done it this way. That's unfair. This is not the right course of action. I can't justify this. And we come up with problems of evil and problems of something where we can't see the things, and therefore we don't give God the benefit of the doubt that there are bigger picture issues. And in the case of Joshua and Caleb, he has to manage so many different constraints, so many different values that he's trying to teach these people and trying to fulfill a promise that trickles down to us. You know, we're in his mind when this is going down too. You know, he has to think. When he has to, instead of kill all of Israel at the golden calf, he has to leak it to Moses to get Moses to argue with him, because the people in the forum class at PBC on Sunday, October 10th. That's a tough job. I don't want that. It's complicated. But it's done with a good heart, and it reaches, blood trickles all the way through into the nooks and crannies of our lives. So wicked. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those that hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of His servants, and none of those who take refuge in Him will be condemned. Here's a case where evil will slay the wicked. Now, the way this worked in the Old Testament, God had built this sort of little experimental bubble. You had a nation, Israel, and the way, if everybody's walking clean, if everybody's walking straight, when you did evil, the consequences would roll back on you immediately. In other words, if you did something wrong, the consequence engine was supposed to be flawless in that day, and so instantly the fruit of your evil would fall back upon you as the evildoer, and you would die or be taken out of the, and the nation would be purified, and the community would keep growing. That was the way it was supposed to work. There was supposed to be enough purity and enough unhindered action on the part of the God in their midst. A community of faith that acknowledged Him in all His ways, and He was directing paths, to where that consequence engine was supposed to be fixing things. So the bad would die out early in that scenario, and the good things, because of the consequence, would blossom. tremendously. And it was not a symmetrical relationship, which meant when, if I did evil as head of household on my tax thing, I said head of household, if I did evil and all my extended family, the three generations lived in that house with me, they would go down with me. Okay, depending upon the type of offense, not always, but types of offenses where a head of household did it that required the cooperation of the eldest sons. So adult sons would live with you as a grandfather, in some cases a great-grandfather. They would live with you and would have to participate in treachery that I would have to do. There wasn't a lot of secret crime done by individuals because everybody lived together. It was a very, very close-knit community. The cities were very small. And so crime that my household did with me as the leader generally involved the full complicity, the full cooperation and buy-in on the part of my direct reports, my kids, okay, my adult sons and adult daughters. And in this kind of scenario, you have the difficulty in the statement of God's justice. He says, I'd visit the sins of the father upon the children to three generations, basically the household units. In other words, if it's that kind, I'm going to go that far. But to those that show love and mercy, to 1,000 generations. It's not symmetrical. The consequence engine was designed not to be symmetrical. You were supposed to be able to outrun with goodness evil. We're supposed to be able to outrun it because that was the way it was to do. That's why in Galatians, you know, when it comes down to it, you always go back to sowing. Sowing. You just try to, in the worst of times, you try to sow a little good. Because a little good gives a thousandfold profit. It heals things. It outruns bad things that you do and bad choices that you make in your life. And so the consequence engine that God did, it was supposed to work flawlessly. Now, when things get polluted, you know, when nobody's sort of playing with the program and we've all just systematically pushing God outside the camp, as a nation, the consequence engine doesn't work as cleanly and the wicked rule. They get wicked because the judgment doesn't fall as fast because I've pushed God out. And if you remember a couple years ago, we talked about God, His presence as the epicenter of action. The closer you get to God, the closer the things work that are supposed to do. Things happen faster. People got judged the closer that they got, for good or ill, they got closer. When the ark stayed at the home of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, when David was afraid to bring it to Jerusalem, he blessed the household. All they did was sit there in a closet. They didn't really have closets back in those days, but it was just sitting there, and he blessed the household. They didn't do anything. You think this is a Gittite. You know, he's not an Israelite, necessarily. He might have been, but probably not. And God blessed that household because it was an epicenter. And so the wicked, when they get to power, that means that the whole system is starting to slow down. And this is why you need to get as close as possible to God so that transformation power of Romans 12, 1 and 2, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, never stops. You've got to stay with it. The closer you get to God, the faster that fire burns, the faster that transformation occurs, and you can keep ahead of it. You can keep ahead of despair, cynicism, alienation, anger, things of this type. So the wicked, oppressors, of course, these are all in the same category, enemy, wicked, oppressors. So I will deliver you from the hand of the wicked. I will redeem you from the grasp of the violent. The violent's got them already. They're not just running from them. They're caught here from someone that intends to do them harm. Redeem me from the oppression of man that I may keep your law. In other words, if I get oppressed, my freedom is so severely restricted that there are things I can't go to Jerusalem and worship. I can't celebrate with my family like I'm supposed to if I'm captured, if I'm locked in a prison. Or deliver me from the hand of the adversary, or redeem me from the hand of the tyrants. And again, you have oppressors. It goes to death and grave. So we start moving into things that look more to the future here, because the Israelite would ask God for deliverance from death, often from violent death, or in some cases from ignoble death. So let's look at a couple of these. This is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words. As sheep they are appointed for Sheol. That's the word for grave. basically. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning, after the distress has passed. And their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. See, the grave and death had a power in ancient Israel as it does now. Death is always just sucking away at us, trying to draw us in, degeneration in our relationships and our hopes, our clarity of vision. It's always just eating at us. It's always after us. And it pulls in those that choose to go in that path, as in the case of the wicked, the foolish. But God can break that cycle, that consequence engine. God can break that cycle, can inject life in that. Not only can he preclude from death, he can pull off resurrections from death, the tiny little, what we call the little deaths that we have in our lives. But God will redeem my soul, will buy me out of that power, will rescue me out. But he used the word redeem instead of just rescue. It cost God something. It's not clear at these point in the passages what it cost God, but we'll see this a little later. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget none of his benefits, who pardons all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit. Now this, for those of you that weak stomachs, this is not the barbecue pit that he is redeeming. This is from the word pit is Sheol, or the grave. It's seen as this thing that just, you, if you don't pay attention to it, you'll fall over in it. It's the way it worked in Israel. It was always out after you. The grave was always hungry, to use the biblical image. It was always thirsty. It was always hungry. And so, as you can imagine, in the ancient world, longevity was not a very frequent thing for the rank and file. Israelite lifespans were a little bit longer, actually, than the people around them. And part of that was some of the sanitation laws that we think that were part of the Mosaic Law. But generally speaking, it was a constant issue. The normal means of death back in those days was disease. And so in the promises in Deuteronomy, when God says, if we keep this together, if we build community with me as a member of this community, these diseases won't be there. The diseases of Egypt will not be upon you, and I will protect you from these things. I will keep those from you. We will minimize that. Even the plagues that God visits upon Israel at extreme times of judgment on the part of its leaders are minute compared to the plagues in the ancient world. The three-day plague, when David did the census, killed six digits worth of people. 3 days of plagues is a miracle in itself. There was a 400-year plague in the Roman Empire. There were 10-year plagues in Assyria and Babylon. There were 150-year plagues in the early Roman in the Republic. Plagues and diseases in the ancient world were not measured in days or months. They were measured in decades. And this is just something weird about Israel, where God had somehow said, here are the parameters. I'm trying to keep you as a community for your experience, fullness of life. And the grave was something that was always there in front of them, from them. Bless the Lord, O my soul. I just read that. Redeemed your life from the pit. In famine, he will redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. Famine, of course, is another problem, a common problem in the ancient world. As you get sedentary and you cease to be nomadic, and you can't move and your population gets quite large, famine is an issue. Famine is a huge issue. And famine, of course, is one of the major feeds of disease, as we know in the modern world as well. So, again, there was in the Old Testament, God said, if you followed my law, there should not be any poor among you. And then elsewhere he says, but there will always be poor among you. And guess whose fault that is? Us. There was no need for that, but we just didn't. We didn't follow instructions. We didn't follow instructions. And the instructions, by the way, weren't perfection instructions, because there was plenty in the instructions of fallback measures. Because every time I violated an instruction, did I have a recourse? Absolutely. We spent a whole year studying this last year. It's on sacrifice. There were always ways to recover, because it's not symmetrical, remember? It was doable. It was doable. Death in the grave. And then punishment for sin. And here we get closer to home, to us New Testament people. Israel, hope in the Lord, For with the Lord there is loving kindness, of loyalty, of faithfulness. And with him is abundant redemption, not just meager redemption, but abundant. And he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. Now see, the psalmist knew that one of Israel's problems was Israel's behavior. Okay? In other words, they were always saying, I have got myself in trouble, and sometimes it's me. Not just that they're violent oppressors, and it's not I'm just being victimized by the system again, you know, and all these people are out to get me. This is I have messed up royally, in the case of David, or just messed up generally, in the case of us rank and file type, and I'm in trouble and I need help. I am sorry. I apologize. I agree with you that the behavior was destructive. You were right. I am wrong. And hopefully I have learned from this, God, not to repeat this. Even a monkey learns to duck. I hope I have learned to duck this time. Can you cut the consequence engine short a little this time? And I'll do my best not to do this again, get this in trouble, do this damage again. So this was the thing that the individual Israelite in the Psalms looked at. Okay. So this first bullet had to do with the individual Israelites' experience, some of the individual Israelites' experiences that God was individually involved in our lives, not just as a corporate God. He's just not the God of the nation Israel, and therefore he only listens when the official people of the nation pray, the prophets, priests, kings, and sages. But when little Glenn Israelite, over here out in the living outside the town, out in the villages, faces oppression, danger, sickness, famine, I can still talk to this God. I can still appeal to this God to redeem me and rescue. I can call upon him. And when I use the word Goel to appeal to God's for rescue, I say, you are one, I am one of yours. I belong to you somehow, some way, because of this next bullet, when they were originally redeemed from Egypt. And let's start into this. We've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to start in this because this defines the basis of how we get to do this going forward. Say therefore, this is the Exodus, and this is where God is the Redeemer in Exodus. He's acting as the Goel kinsman. He's somehow related to the Israelites. They are in bondage, in oppressive slavery in Egypt for 4 centuries roughly. Say therefore to the sons of Israel, I am Yahweh, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage. I will also redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. So outstretched arm is a labor reference and fighting and personal investment, and great judgments is a legal image that I am going to visit into the law court, and I'm going to judge Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt because of the way you, as the Asiatics, have been treated. Then I will take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And then you have the prayer to this God. You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the peoples. With your mighty arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. Now, the odd thing about this is that the word redeemed is used here, because it says, with your mighty arm and your strong judgments, you have not rescued us, per se, but you redeemed us. You bought us with your arm somehow. See? It's like some kind of legal buying, legal court judgment that was done with the mighty arm of God. And let's look at what a couple of comments on this are from a couple of scholars, two scholars on this. What gives the metaphor of redemption, of buying something, for us is the constant presence of the price-paying idea. It always costs something. But it is precisely that is disputed by some who think that redemption is no more than another way of saying deliverance, and that sometimes it looks that way in the Old Testament. The big reason for thinking this is that there are some Old Testament passages where Yahweh is said to have redeemed his people, and it is unthinkable that he should pay a price to anybody. But too much is being deduced. The metaphor has not been robbed of its point. For example, the saying, he sold his life dearly, as we would use today. Sometimes in the Old Testament, Yahweh is thought of as being so powerful that all the might of the nations is but a puny thing before him. Isaiah 40 comes to mind. The nations are but dust. Just blows off the palm of his hand. But redemption is not used in such passages. Where redemption occurs, there is the thought of effort. Yahweh redeems, quote, with a stretched out arm. He makes known his strength. Because he loves his people, he redeems them at cost to himself. His effort is regarded as the price. That is the whole point of using the redemption terminology. Next quote. Examination of the passages in which Yahweh is the subject reveals the interesting fact that in many places, the redemption he effects is not regarded as something he performs with effortless ease. Okay, it's not pictured that way when the word redemption is meant. Yet in other passages, sometimes not far from the redemption ones, the idea is put forward that all the might of the nations is but a puny thing, a thing of naught in his sight. But though they accept this thought, when the Bible writers think of Yahweh as Redeemer, they prefer to think of him as putting forward a strong effort. Thus we read, I will redeem you with a stretched out arm. Thou art the God that doest wonders. Thou hast made known thy strength among the peoples. Thou hast with thine arm redeemed thy people. Enter not into the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong. Their Redeemer is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. He shall thoroughly plead his cause. This stress on Yahweh's effort seems to be the reason for applying the redemption terminology to his dealings. This effort is regarded as the price which gives point to the metaphor. Yahweh's action is at cost to himself. While he could, so to speak, cope with a situation with a small expenditure of effort, yet because he loves his people, he has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. Somehow it's at a cost. When the New Testament comes, it's fairly clear what this cost is. It's in the very title called the cross. Right? In the Old Testament, it's less explicit. Is that somehow God has got to get involved, but there was some personal cost that was unspecified for when he did this. When we meet next week, we'll talk about some of the dynamics of what it cost the heart of God to visit plagues upon people. There's a separate issue that has to do when he inflicts discipline and judgment upon the lives of others. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we are needy people. We are always in situations that cause us to look up to you, whether they are causes of celebration or causes for imprecation, for imploring you for your rescue and your redemption, your ransom, that you would be our kinsman, that you would be our relative, that you would be someone that has a commitment to us in solidarity with us, one among us, that you would show yourself strong for the various needs here in this class and otherwise, Father. We would ask that as we would reflect upon these things, that the ancient Israelite, even back then, knew that they could call upon you for individual actions and initiatives on your part in their daily lives. Minute aspects of the nation's experience, but something so big to the heart of the Israelite that they felt comfortable, that they could approach you and know that you were a good-hearted God. We would ask, Father, that this day, this week, that we would seek your heart out more and call upon you as knowing that you will drop what you are doing, that you will come to stand with us in court, that you will come to stand with us in our tribulations and our challenges and our distresses and be one with us and to represent us and protect us and sometimes cut off the consequence engine or soften the blows and help us when we are helpless and we are in need of help. We ask you these things, recognizing the great display of this that you did in our history in the person of your Son upon that cross when we were helpless, yet you died for us. We thank you so much for this and your constant work in our lives. We ask your blessing and your presence in our life this week. For your Son's sake, amen.
gotta wait my time out.